This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote with two excellent poets, Christina Daub and Ellen Weiss. And each one is going to tell you who they are by what they read. And we'll hear Christina Daub read an opening poem right now.
Thank you, Grace. It's a delight to be here with the two of you. This poem is called Charge, and the title refers to both kinds of charge, charging ahead, and what we charge ourselves to do in our lives. Charge. After the lion finishes grooming his singular body with rough licks, after the porcupine waddles away, after night devours the sun, the dark tail twitches, new scents worry the air, and the lion stops resting under his rock, his large claws scraping the dust. Hunger moves with the pride. It leaps and drags and chews until the bones dry inside. A lion may outrun a goat or not. Hunger is outrunning the earth.
Powerful. Ellen, open up with a poem.
This is called Dusk on the Marshy Hope. And the Marshy Hope is a little river, narrow, I mean, because it's 37 miles long. It's a tributary of the Nanticoke, and it winds its way slowly through the Delmarva Peninsula. Dusk on the Marshy Hope. Last tincture of pink infuses the marshy hope. A trillion bugs chant lamentations to the fading day. The current snakes along as slow as crabbers talk, of plum stem boughs and counter sterns, dead rise destinations. Ask an old man how his scow's been holding up. He might say, she's still leaking, could use right smart of caulk, but her engine's still a honey, and crabs is sweet this season. Stink of salt marsh permeates the low tide's locks. The great blue, bowed among the mallows, shrugs. Her prehistoric squawk backwashes bank to muddy bank. Legs splayed, she casts her awkward weight against the dark, as though to wedge a hatch from sliding shut. Caught between apricot dusk and the sky's reflected face, a brackish swamp, she doesn't so much fly. Broad, uneven wing beats echo down the shallows as kedge herself toward lightness.
I bet you're a boatmaker's wife. I can tell by that poem. So you heard Christina and Ellen, and I'm going to ask Ellen something personal. You're putting together your first book.
That's right.
Very tender subject. So how do you go about this? How do you manage to put the poems in order so you think people will keep reading? What are the choices you're making? And what's the problem?
Wow. Well, that's a lot of questions, but I pulled out every poem I had just about, and then I sifted through wondering whether they would really talk to each other since they were so many from so long a time. And to my surprise, to my real surprise, they did talk to each other. I seem to have a vocabulary after all, the way that I've noticed so many poets do. And certain obsessions, you know, that kind of come through. And so with that, boosting my courage, I spread them out along a long tabletop, and I sorted and sorted until I found pages that spoke to each other and then sections that spoke to each other. And I think there's many ways to put a book together, but that was my sort of shuffling, I guess you could say, of the poems until they seemed to find their time from actually early childhood through a long marriage until, you know, my present day with some new poems.
Well, no wonder they all came forward with your voice, because they're all from the same source. And so I do not belittle our early poems, because they came from the same well. And I'm not surprised that they worked really well. We can just give it a good luck blessing, but Christina and I can just bless that book and hope it gets accepted. I think it will. Let's hear another poem, Ellen, from your obsessions.
Okay. This one is called Snowbound. And the poem setting is the small town in Ohio that was my birthplace. Snowbound. Deep in snow, I trudge, a young girl alone, dragging a borrowed toboggan behind me to the cemetery where a forbidden hill runs down to wood's dark edge. Clutching the reins of an imagined sleigh, I speed down, standing up. At bottom, the shock sends me flying where snow-shrouded rock strikes bone. I lie listening a long, cold time to the wind sigh and moan in the snow-burdened pines. Then I stand, limp back up the hill and home. 6 decades on, I dream that frozen blank expanse where I had gone alone to find where my young father lay, his headstone deep in snow.
Listen to that. Lies a long, cold time, sigh and moan in the snow. You really love those one-syllable words, don't you, Ellen?
I am in love with words.
You love words. I know. Well, Christina, I want to tell you who both of these people are, because I know them. And you've just heard Ellen, and she's been appearing in many, many journals, including Beltway Quarterly, Delmarva Review. She was awarded Bread Loaf's Donald Everett Exon Scholarship in Poetry, a Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation Creative Fellowship, and a Maryland State Arts Council Individual Artist Award. So she's booking. And we have Christina here also. Christina won the Enoch Pratt Poetry Prize and has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize, the Best of the Net. She's co-founder and co-editor of the international poetry journal, The Plum Review. So, Christina, tell us about what you entered and what you won.
Oh, for the Enoch Pratt? It was just
What was the contest?
The contest was for Maryland poets, and 371 people were allowed to send in one poem for Maryland residents. And I had written a poem titled At Calvert Cliffs and sent that in. And in the last minute, a friend of mine from the West Coast said, oh, you should enter. So I did, and I won. It was very exciting.
And we will not hear that poem, but we will hear another poem. And I'll tell you everyone honestly why. It is absolutely gorgeous. It's about the death of her husband. And I'll tell you, when she sent it to me, I started crying and I said, guess what? Let's not cry on the video. Let's just show people where they can read it. So where can they read it, Christina?
They can find it on my website, christinadaub.com.
Okay. That sounds easy enough. And what else would we find on your website?
You would find several other poems of mine that are up there. The one that won the Best of the Net and the Pushcart Prize, and other events that I've been part of or hosted. This new book coming out that I'm editing with Hiram LaRue called Turning Poetry into Food, a collection of Poetry X Hunger poems, which will come out this fall. Very excited about that.
Wow. Yeah. Well, let's hear two poems from you.
Okay. I have two poems about and for my father. My father came to this country in the early 1950s from Germany, had been in the war, and had never, ever talked about his experiences there until the very end of his life when he came to live with us and I dared to ask him. So this first poem is called Strawberries, which is his favorite fruit. Strawberries. I hold steady, knife tip circling, digging out the tufty green crowns before I slice the carmine hearts into the white bowl. Sunday morning ritual. My father's head bowed slightly, each bite a hush, lush joy, heaped stainless spoon he held to the light. He who woke nights through my childhood screaming. Sold to a prison camp as a boy after the war. His job was to sweep the mines from beaches where few returned. To claim a gurney until freed, he pierced and re-pierced his bullet wound. Inside the strawberry, pinpoint stars spray from its pale center, where I keep him, where I have always kept him, my father, his face lit by the pink, juice-stained bowl. In a dream, I touch his strawberry-shaped scar, inverse volcano, and it heals.
He pierced and replaced his bullet wound. He pierced and replaced his bullet wound.
And re-pierced. Yeah.
And re-pierced. That's all you have to say. And more.
And this one is a sonnet called Minus the Body, or My Father, 1926 to 2010. Say goodbye to sourdough in the oven and the grass just cut a scent you'd roll down your window for. The earth breathing again after a cold spring. Close the door to Mozart, his sonatas for violin, to books and beaches and beds, dreams which lit, then scattered like dandelion seeds. It is time for the crossing. Shed whatever's left. Regret, old letters, the absurd attachment to things. Pack only what won't tip the boat. Love, forgiveness, the oars of celebration. You are light now, air in a canoe. Wherever the river takes you is there and here. Ignore our mourning. We are behind in letting go.
I've heard letting go in every way possible, except I just heard it for the first time today. Now I know why you can translate from German. I knew you could translate from Spanish. Was German spoken in your home?
My parents would speak German with each other. My mother was American, and she learned it when they didn't want the kids to know what was going on. So I was very motivated to learn German.
Have you used it in poetry, in translating poetry?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I had forgotten that. Tell me a little bit more about that. What did you translate?
I've translated some of the work of Friederike Mayröcke, who's an Austrian poet, wonderful poet, a bit abstract, so it's really a challenge. I translated a little bit of Goethe. I now found another poet that I want to translate, but since he's a living poet, I have to go get his permission.
Oh, that'll be exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you inquired yet? Have you approached him yet?
Not yet.
What do you like about him?
He's very spiritual. He's very sort of cone-like in his writing. It's beautiful, really beautiful writing.
We're going to look for that, just like we're looking for the first book coming out from Ellen. We're giving it a blessing with this program. I'm going to ask you each the same question, and don't copy each other. So, Christina... And both of you, I'm going to ask myself this too. Why are you committing your life to poetry? What's in it for you? What's in it for anybody? Why have you decided to make this matter? And does it matter? And why are we doing this? And so each of you, please chime in. People wonder. You know, people wonder what we're doing. Christina, what do you have to say?
Well, to me, I think poetry is a calling. And I remember writing something in the ninth grade, and it was the first time actually I could please this English teacher. And once I got beyond that sort of temporary pleasure, I thought, wow, this is the language of the soul. This is the language of the emotions. You know, I grew up in a house where you weren't really allowed to express yourself, and it was very quiet. And this was a way that I could kind of create something, bring something to the world that was part of me. And poetry is the language of intimacy. It's the highest art form using language, I think. And if you love music, and I didn't have musical talent, but I can infuse music into my lines. I think a lot about sound when I write, and I can't imagine life without poetry. I just couldn't do it.
I love the word intimate with poetry. You're quite right. Nothing gets, we're so vulnerable with a poem, and that's the gift we give to the world, our vulnerability. And Ellen, why are you in this mess with us?
Well, I guess, you know, it's sort of, I can't help it. It's the way that I am able to forge a connection with others, whether I know them or not. It's a way for me to feel that I can love the world. And it's so hard to talk about, but I too grew up in a home where there was a lot of not saying. And I think that really did kind of push me over into wanting to break that kind of silence. I don't fault anyone that keeps their peace, but I feel that for me, I cannot exist without the saying.
We all want to be heard. We all want to be heard.
There's a line from a poem I read recently by Derek, the Irish poet Derek Mahon, and it's from the poem "Everything Is Going to Be All Right," and it really resonated with me when he says, "The lines flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart." That just seems so right. I hadn't known.
That is so right. It is. Give us a poem, Ellen. Give us a poem about Florence.
This is was written in Florence after seeing the famous frescoes of Adam and Eve from two sort of dueling Renaissance poets. One was before and one was after the expulsion from the garden. This is called Brancacci Chapel, Florence. In the dim shush of the frescoed chapel, crowded as a tour bus with its scenes of saints and angels, the Byzantine Madonna's tears are glittering obsidian. Masolino's Adam stands graceful and manly, darker by a shade or two than Eve, with her flesh pale as polenta, ripe as a pear, belly swollen with abundance. The undulating serpent wears a tiny human mask, a small round mirror in which I recognize myself as something other. Forever in their innocence, across the vaulted synapse, they face their own expulsion. About suffering, Masaccio knew the best is never yet to come. This Adam hides his face, a cipher buried in both hands. For Eve, there is no holding back. She howls her naked aria. It echoes in the chapel even now.
I'm already there. I'm already there. Ellen has also been published in numerous journals, and she had a wonderful production of her poetry that I saw at St. John's College. How did that come together, Ellen?
Well, it was a strange experience, but I had just started writing poetry, and I had a best friend. She's gone now. Agnes, I think you saw her. I know you saw her sing. She was a wonderful singer and teacher of voice. And I sent this poem to her for her birthday because it had a lot of musical images. And the images caught her eye, and she shared it with a friend who at Old Dominion, who was the composer in residence. And he's a very celebrated composer. His name is wonderful. It's Adolphus Hale Stork III. And Adolph, as we called him, liked it and asked me for more poems and selected five and went to the VCCA retreat and wrote a song cycle that he produced. And it was just one of his many compositions. Mm-hmm. He's done symphonies and everything.
Did you love it? Did you love watching yourself? Did you love hearing what you are through two other people, the musician?
It was extraordinary. It was an extraordinary experience. And I felt so fortunate. I know it was because of Agnes that he, you know, wanted to write something special for her as a soprano.
Well, wait a minute. Don't be too modest. He wouldn't have taken bad material.
No, that's true. But just the thought that he took some of my very first poems and created something so beautiful, I just was flabbergasted, and I sort of feel like Robert Frost said, it's one of the poet's highest, you know, hopes that someday a few of his poems will be lodged in a place that'll be hard to get rid of.
Oh, that's wonderful. But it also is a good kiss on the cheek, too. So I'm going to go back to Christina, who also has exemplified her life in production, and hers was in print. And Christina, I was a big fan of the Plum Review. I think it was one of the best curated magazines in the country. Just give us a little bit about how you did that and what it did for America.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much. Well, it started when I was getting my MFA at Maryland, and I would carpool with another poet named Mike Hammer. And in our rides back and forth to school, we would talk about the literary magazines and where were we going to, you know, get our poems published? Who would take our baby poems when all of the magazines at that time seemed to be publishing the same established older male poets over and over. And so then we started talking, well, who would we publish if we had our own magazine? And then it started, sort of the vision started and the visualizing, and suddenly we were starting a literary journal together while in school and while I was pregnant with my first son. So the first one came out, the first call that we put out for poems, we got 1,000 poems that first week. So clearly there was a need for another literary journal on the scene. And we had talked to, you know, Rick Peabody, who is such a literary fixture in our area. And we had talked to Ethelbert, and everyone we talked to said, yeah, do it. We need it. Go for it. So we had a lot of support. And by the time we had the third issue, we got a grant from CLMP. Mike had a friend who was over in Brussels, a poet, and she came on as our sort of international editor, and she sent us poems, and then we had got translations, and it just kind of really blossomed.
And you got some big names in there, too, so there was a little bit of snobbery. You didn't mind the biggest poets in America submitting.
Well, we figured we needed some, you know, big names, and we got big women's names too, by the way, in order to get the attention, in order to attract people.
No question. And how many years in running was that?
We did 10 issues. It was about almost not quite 7 years. And we were very conscious about having 50% male poets, 50% female, and then a lot of emerging voices as well.
And diverse, you were quite diverse as well, as I remember.
Yes.
Okay, give us two poems together.
Okay. We have, this one is called Greening. And I write a lot about light, and so I wanted to write about what can be birthed in the darkness. And you can't really have light without the dark. So greening. So much begins inside a clamped shell, a hard seed, the cold black earth, a dark room waiting for the image to unfurl, the back of a jazz club, space between notes, silent pauses, the unknown, unspoken island erupting into existence from the bottom of an ink black sea. And you, in the womb, a light I feel strumming, earthing, almost ready to unroot.
And another.
And another. This one is Morning Doves. And there's a line that has the swoop and three waves in it, which is the sound of the morning dove, the sort of morning doves. Some days when January's drifts block the door and ice swords bar my windows, when it's hard to remember the hearth's cold ashes were once fire, and I want to give up on the world and what it's become, love enters in the swoop and three waves of dove song. The black cat pawing the glass because huddled a few feet away, two doves, unruffled in icy wind, grip a thin branch and rest. They do not choose to live or to let go. Whether in their cells or in the fusions of their bones, they know that ice must melt this shadowed snow. What winter locks in must eventually grow.
Christina, I love your vowels.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, I really am very moved by the way you read as well. You ride the vowels. That's a good thing. I guess that's what I always want people to do. You really literally make them fluid because they're meant to be, right? We're meant to ride them, and you do that so well. Christina, you've been writing for how many years?
Oh my gosh, since the ninth grade. Decades.
Okay, we won't count then. We won't count. But what have you learned about yourself?
Through writing?
Mm-hmm. It's the only way we do learn, through poetry. What did you discover that you didn't know as you wrote poetry about who you are?
Okay. I guess I learned that I really listen. I listen not just to people, but I listen when I'm outside. And I frequently, something will come to me that I've overheard that sort of germinates a poem. I think I've learned to be a more sensitive person in the world. And maybe also more, since poetry is such a vehicle for our vulnerabilities, I feel like I have to protect myself a little more too.
That's honest. That is really honest, yeah. So it is an act of discovery, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what I heard you say is that you pay attention, that you're paying attention, whether you're looking or hearing. That's what I heard you say. And so as far as our intentions are, then Ellen, you're a painter as well as a poet. So you have these two aesthetics going on, and I'm interested in what is different about each of them as far as your ability to proceed. So what is alike about you in reference to them? And what is the difference about your approach to these two arts, painting and poetry?
You know, I've thought about this. I thought I would always be a painter exclusively, and I came to writing really kind of late, just sort of happened like a late blossoming. It was, I'll credit Washington College and their creative writing program. And I was, but as far as what do they take that is the same or different? I think they come from the same place. The painting is something that I didn't always know what it was about until I stood back or some time had elapsed and I saw really what the painting wanted to be or became without my really knowing. My approach to poetry is actually the same. Mm-hmm. I start a poem, I don't know where it's going to go. I sort of follow it, if you will. And there's a special kind of magic to that and a letting go that I love, that means that the poem will take you to someplace very surprising. And that's what I learned from it about myself that I didn't know.
That is fabulous. Ellen, I'm glad you brought up Washington College because that is someplace, not only did you study there, but you are now a main player in bringing forth poets together every year for a very special retreat. And it is going into our fourth year.
We have done 5.
Wow. Well, you are amazing. Painter, administrator, poet. Let us have a final poem from each of you. Christina Daub first, and then Ellen Weiss next. Thank you.
Thank you. This is called Rabbits at Dusk, and you'll hear the word you, which is the plant, not the animal. Rabbits at dusk. In the slow lilt of evening, the lawn exhales a mist and rabbits emerge from the yew's dark pockets. They pause, ears twitching, small, quick gods of the grass. Listen to the hush between trees, the wind's breath through wild thyme. The almost imperceptible shift of hawk wings drawing the sky closer. Do they know, these soft messengers of dusk, that they are watched, that the world leans in to witness their gentle alchemy, how they soften the dark with life? Tonight, rabbits are the quiet keepers of the tender, trembling edge of day. They graze beneath the moon's pale eye, and the lawn for a moment is endless.
And Ellen.
This is Drowned Islands, Late November. Drowned Islands, Late November. By skiff we pass through winding cuts, lined in dense black mud. Like love, it's pliant enough to be held or dissolved. Past banks, anchored by high grasses, going green to gold to gray. A great blue heron casts a cold eye, registers her complaint. A marsh blackbird sits perpendicular to a reed, flaunts his bright patch. Unofficial channel mark, red, right, returning. The shorebirds are gone. Shearwater, oyster catcher, sandpiper, curlew. The surf scatters its scoured shells. Like the last standing, cobbled together, shack on stilts, I lean into myself.
I'm already at the Eastern Shore, Ellen. And these are the voices of Christina Daub and Ellen Weiss. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote, and it's produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Sinipet Fund and the Bravada Foundation of the Logan family. Friends of the program, also, Natalie Canavor, Avide Shoshani, Yoon Ki Kim Renault, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. Thank you.